I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. Our guest this week is a familiar guest. James Andrew Miller is the best-selling author of books on ESPN, CAA, Saturday Night Live, the host of the Origins podcast. He's been a guest on this podcast many times. We're going to talk about what ESPN in 2021 will look like and the importance of the NFL to ESPN regarding the upcoming media rights negotiation, but we're taping this podcast on the morning of January 7th after, quite frankly, one of the darkest days for democracy, certainly in my lifetime, I would imagine almost anybody's lifetime, and truly one of the worst days that the United States has experienced in some time. I'm not a historian and I'm not going to equate it to wars or anything like that, but domestic terrorism at its highest level, and if you were watching the images on television, it was awful to see. Jim, before we get into our ESPN talk, which kind of seems mundane compared to real world issues, you worked, I believe, in the U.S. Capitol for a couple of years. I know you wrote, I believe you wrote a book on either working at the Senate, or you can sort of explain it, but you know, people know you for your work on sort of entertainment books, but before that, you were in politics, correct? I'll give you the floor here.
I was, yes. My first book was about the Senate, and I worked there for several years. It was the greatest job of my life.
And what senator did you work for, if I could ask?
I worked for Howard Baker when he was Senate Majority Leader, so I had the distinct honor, as they say in the Senate, of walking onto the Senate floor every day, several times a day, and particularly in the morning when we when the boss opened the Senate, usually at 9:30 in the morning. And you know, I mean, it's I think it's something that people who work in that building and work on the Hill feel. It sounds kind of corny, but you know, it's just a really special place. And it stays with you. And so yesterday was a fundamentally sad day to think about the disrespect and the horror that was involved. I mean, obviously, since 1814, in the War of 1812, since then, no one has terrorized that building and invaded that building like it was yesterday. And this isn't a matter of politics. This isn't a matter of, like, you know, whether you believe in this kind of policy or not. This is about democracy and the respect for our democracy and our institutions and our beautiful buildings and the lives of those people who were serving at that time. It's just shocking.
So I want to ask you about that. When you saw the images of, you know, broken windows and paper strewn all over the floor and people sitting in Congress people's offices and people walking through those halls with weaponry and stuff like that. Yeah, could you put your mind into, you know, you like in another universe, Jim, 20 years ago, whenever it was for you, 30 years ago, like you would have been one of those staffers. You would have been getting the call that the Capitol is in lockdown and here's what you are instructed to do. And like, I can't even imagine being a 25 or 28 year old staffer thinking, oh my God, like, is someone coming to kill me today?
Right. Well, I mean, I think you at that moment you're probably thinking less about, I mean, you're thinking about your safety, but you're also just in shock that this could even happen. I guess there's going to have to be a almost like a 9/11 level investigation here, because it was no secret for weeks that this was being planned. And the one thing that I came to learn and to really appreciate about the Capitol Police is they're amazing people. And the level of security when I worked in the Senate was fundamentally different, but the Capitol Police were always there, and they were this wonderful group of people who really cared about the building and really cared about everybody inside the building. And there was a very, very thin membrane around inside the Capitol to deal with those people. And you saw the numbers that were, you know, coming up on social media and then in the mall area the day before. And it just was shocking and sad. And we have to kind of trace the pedigree of what actually happened in the other way, because I felt like a lot of those people were utterly defenseless. And I think there's going to be some serious revelations about some of the things that should have happened that didn't happen. And they're going to be people that are going to have to answer some very, very difficult questions about why certain things weren't done. And sometimes things are rather innocuous. You know, Esper leaves as defense secretary, and they say, oh, a loyalist, you know, comes on as the new defense secretary. Nobody barely even knows his name. But when the call went to the Pentagon for backup, initially there was a no. I mean, what is that all about? Again, this is literally not about politics. It's not even about whether you're a Trump supporter or not. It's about our institutions. It's literally the lifeblood of our democracy. And so it's just, we have to be very, very careful right now at this time, because these are the scenes that we used to see in Latin America and other parts of the world where it made us carsick. It was morally repugnant. It was exactly what the United States was founded to be a symbol against. And now I worry about those countries, and particularly authoritative regimes, looking at us now and thinking that and using that against us. How can next time we go on a mission to protect democracy in some country, someplace, and we're trying to safeguard their elections, and what are they going to say to us? It's just the repercussions are just multi-layered and will be with us for a long time. This is not over just because those people are out of the Capitol and outside the Capitol grounds. This is just beginning. This is something that we're going to have to deal with for years and years to come and get smarter about.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we'll make an awkward transition, but yeah, there are some things about this that I agree with you that are not, it's not about the politics of the moment that go beyond politics, but politics lit a lot of these fuses. Politics has radicalized a lot of people. And
I mean, I'll tell you one thing. I don't mean
we
to interrupt.
Go ahead.
I'll tell you one thing. I feel lucky as hell. And I was talking with a couple of friends who worked in the Senate at the same time I did. When I would walk on the Senate floor sometimes with Senator Baker, you look over to your right and there was Paul Laxalt and Teddy Kennedy laughing together, and they were good friends. I mean, everybody, it was a place where every single morning the objective of the Senate, and particularly the Majority Leader office, were to get things done that day. And it was all about, you know, I remember 2 o'clock in the morning, Senator Baker and Senator Dole and Senator Moynihan, like Republicans and Democrats, trying to do the Social Security Rescue Act to get it saved and to get it done. And everything was eventually, you know, operated between the 40-yard lines to make sure that things got done. And there was an enormous level of respect that members on both sides of the aisle had with each other. And I mean, I had worked for a Democrat before with Baker. Nobody ever asked me. Senator Baker never asked me what party I even belonged to. There was no oath test. It was, it was just an extraordinary time. And yes, obviously it had its problems and there were mistakes made at times. But in terms of the decorum and actually the DNA of the Senate as an institution, it was just, I feel bad for people who don't, who can't remember or don't, who don't know that it actually used to be like that.
Well, that's well said.
And how about those NFL rights?
Yeah, I know. we got some ugly times ahead of us. Hopefully there's light somewhere.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
All right. So there's no really great way to segue to talking about sports media, but we'll do it anyway. It's a big year for ESPN, Jim, 2021. NFL rights are on the table. The sports calendar has changed because of COVID. They have laid off a ton of people, including some, institutional markers there that I think fundamentally change the culture of what that place is. They have cost. They're going to certainly make a clear move to cost savings by doing more games from studios or broadcasters' homes as opposed to travel. So we'll take a big picture question to start here. What's ESPN's biggest challenge, in your opinion, in 2021? What's Jimmy Pitaro's biggest challenge for this upcoming year?
It's so easy. That's an easy question, and we're going to know the answer very soon. It is to, and it's Bob Iger's as well, it is to shove as much toothpaste in the tube, back in the tube as possible on the last NFL deal. And basically what Disney's message to the NFL is we did a $53 billion deal. We've been spending $1.9 billion a season. We got the fourth worst schedule. It looks like they're going to wind up, I would guess, and I've said this to you before, I think they're going to wind up, probably staying with Monday night, but it all comes down to schedule. And they need to get a better schedule for their money. And so I think that what's going to happen is, we're going to see. It's going to be very easy to figure out who won in the sense that is ESPN going to get a better schedule and probably, as we've talked about, the opportunity to flex later on in the season like NBC has, maybe not exactly as many games, but is the Monday Night Football package going to be upgraded significantly? And that means, and by the way, everybody's paying more. So the NFL is still in the driver's seat. Everybody, let's just start at 30,000 feet. Everybody wanted to come back to the table. Everybody wants more of NFL. Remember, there was just all this talk about NFL ratings are down. Who knows what's going to happen? Everybody wants the NFL back. Everybody's at the table. Everybody knows they're going to pay more. The question is Fox, NBC, others going to have to pay more, but not get the guarantees of the schedule that they're getting now? Because once you keep Thursday night, which I think is still the greediest move that the NFL ever made, there just aren't enough good games to go around. And so you have to rob Peter to pay for Paul, and you're just going to have to. So if you're outside Disney, and if Disney gets that upgrade, that means that you're going to be spending more money for games for less guarantees on games than you had before. And that to me is what I want to see coming out of this is how are they going to make it up, quote unquote, to Disney and ESPN. And the thing that I loved the most about writing Those Guys Have All the Fun was going back and deconstructing the negotiations that happened between Disney/ESPN and the NFL. Because remember, ESPN used to have what was called the Sunday night cable package. NBC was out of the football business. Bornstein, Ebersol came back in. they worked out an agreement. Dick got prime time Sunday night game. ESPN got Monday Night Football. And George Bodenheimer, with all due respect, he was thrilled about Monday Night Football because he thought that he was getting Monday Night Football that he grew up with, you know, Howard and Dan and that amazing schedule. They didn't get that. What they got was basically their Sunday night cable schedule. And when the first schedule came out, I mean, I heard this from numerous people. I mean, people at ESPN were in shock. And when they started to realize that, and that premier prime time, big visible Monday night, ABC Monday Night Football schedule went to NBC on Sunday night. That is such a powerful shift. It's just you can't say enough about it. And so for years, ESPN has suffered with that schedule. And yes, have there been some years that have been better than others? Sure. But if you were to take the totality of the Sunday night schedule since the last deal versus the Monday night schedule, it's not even close. It's not even close.
Do you think that... Yeah, it's okay. Do you you think if ESPN retains Monday Night Football and gets part of the Super Bowl rotation, think that's considered enough of a win? If, let's say, the schedule essentially is the same, there's not a, you know, you've talked about inventory. I agree with you. I don't think Thursday night football is going anywhere. There's too much sort of money at stake there. But like, let's just leave it at that. They retain Monday Night Football, but along with the retention, they're part of the Super Bowl rotation. Is that enough of a win for Pitaro and Disney?
You got to tell me the number.
Yeah, I mean, because I don't know what the number is going to be, except it's just going to be an increase on what they're paying now.
Right, but if it's an increase of X versus an increase of Y, for me, the disparity between X and Y has to be strength of schedule. So, I mean, I think that they'll get into the Super Bowl rotation, and I think that they'll probably, if I had to guess, they'll get some flex, which will be important. But if they really get that upgrade of schedule, then whatever they're going to wind up paying will probably be a win for them, and Bob and Jimmy will be able to walk away and say, we have a fundamentally different next 8 or 10 years, whatever it's going to be, than we've had before. So yes, we've upgraded. If they don't get, I mean, if there's for some reason, this is how you can define success for them. If they don't get in the Super Bowl rotation, if they don't get flex, and if they don't get a market improvement in the schedule, then I think that this round of negotiations did not turn out so well for them.
That's an interesting analysis. And again, without, just in terms of sort of talking to people in the industry and sort of reading what other reporters have reported, if you asked me today, I think every existing rights holder is going to re-up, and there probably might be an additional package created for an Amazon type. Might not be Amazon, but I think everybody's going to retain.
Nobody wants Thursday night, so Amazon can have Thursday night.
Here's the one thing, though. Do you think if the number was right, and again, you know, the number's with a B here, but if the number was right, you think Disney would do a Monday night / Thursday night deal and really go all in on two primetime football games a week? I don't even know what that number is, because we're talking just astronomical numbers to start with. But like that ESPN, and I'd have to change a little bit of their programming, but like, you know, that would, if Pitaro's goal via from Disney, which seems to be the case, has been retain the NFL, improve your relationship with the NFL, which I think they've certainly the latter they've done. They're not doing nearly as many investigative pieces, by the way, in the NFL. Just, I'll make a side note there. I don't know, Jim. Like, the, you know, to have two that if your content play now is to sort of make it, you know, we want to go as heavy on the NFL as we can. We're invested in all this college inventory. We have the NBA. We have, you know, far less feature writers now, but newsbreaker types like Woj and Schefter. It's not the craziest thing to think that they may go for an extra game, even if Thursday Night Football is not the greatest property. You know, Thursday Night Football, Jim, on network still brings in $13 million. That'd be the best program on ESPN every single week by far.
I don't know if they want to spend that money for. I don't know if they want to spend that money for a Thursday night. And also remember, on Thursday night they can't put it on ABC because that's too disruptive to the ABC ecosystem. You know, you have scripted program. You have
football would blow away the scripted programming though, right now, unless it's a mega hit, right?
I understand. By the way, you should look at the top shows of 2020 and go on a treasure hunt for a scripted program. But I still think that that's too fundamental a statement. And
by the way, as a little funny game here, I don't even know if this is still on. Do you know what's on Thursday nights on ABC? By the way, I didn't know until I just Googled this. Station 19. Have you even heard of that?
Oh, right. Station 19. Right.
Gray's Anatomy.
Well, of course. I mean, Gray's Anatomy is, you know, that's a big show.
It is, but I bet. I mean, without checking, and if someone's listening to this and I turn out to be wrong, I'm an idiot. I bet you Thursday Night Football beats Gray's Anatomy in 2020. Don't you think?
But there's the other considerations too, because it's about the affiliates. It's about the opportunity to move around your schedule. It's, you know, years ago, NBC, I think it was Jeff Zucker who ultimately made the decision.
By the way, Grey's Anatomy getting crushed by Thursday Night Football. Apologies, Jim. I just
yeah. I mean, it's not. I'm sure it's not even close. But remember when they stripped Jay Leno at 10 o'clock? You know, because they were going to try to figure out the new ways, and that didn't that wasn't a success. I mean, there's going to be changes in the next few years about that whole scripted system and the economics of how they deal with the affiliates and original programming and everything else. I just think that I don't know, maybe ESPN would do it, but it would be costly.
I'm not sure. I agree with you. I think that would come down to cost, and I think so much of that would be about like what does the NFL have in terms of in terms of other suitors for Thursday. I think Fox clearly wants out of it. I don't think there's a question about that. So it's one to watch. Again, that's not based on any reporting. That's just me sort of spitballing into the wind. The other thing I wanted to sort of get on in terms of 2021 is what ESPN is going to be doing, Jim. They're going to be doing a lot less people now. And so, you know, what do you think that means, one, to sort of, one, what they are, and two, and I know you talk to people there, like, what does it mean to the culture? Because your whole, I mean, I feel like one sort of major sort of thematic part of your book was like the culture of ESPN and like working there and how people felt about being there, and they invested their lives to move to Bristol. And, you know, in some ways it was a family, in some ways it was a cult. Now, given the, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it's just like any other company, it's still a destination job, but man, the staffing levels are a lot different in 2021 than even like 2016.
Well, of course. And look, part of it is just the simple arithmetic of going from 100 million homes paying $7 or $8 a month to 77 million homes or 78 million. There have been a lot of people that have been let go, and I think that there have been incredible names attached to those departures. But ESPN will tell you, and it's true, if you look, there's still terrific people there. You just mentioned Woj. By the way, It's every time I look at Holly speaking yesterday, again, this is not about politics.
Oh, yeah. You're thinking about Woj's response, of course.
I was thinking about Woj and the bonus that he's due. But anyway, I think that there are.
Yeah, you think ESPN is going to send him a check, post check, saying, "Hey, sorry about that." Yeah, I don't think so.
Still a sitting member. He's still a sitting member of Congress. But I do believe. Look, there's still a lot of great people there, and they're still doing a lot of interesting work, but it's just different. It's just different. And remember, the other thing is that sometimes a company mirrors its leader. And I think that that's something that people sometimes don't pay attention to. But, you know, when you're in that job, particularly at a place like ESPN, and particularly at the time that Skipper was in that job, where he was trying to be as independent as possible from Burbank and often didn't take not often, but sometimes didn't take Burbank's lead on things and had a huge budget and a lot of control over that budget. I think that his interests in journalism, enterprise journalism, and certain people, I don't want to say he collected people, but particularly with John Walsh and Skipper, they were on a buying spree for a long time. And you think about when John Walsh was remaking SportsCenter, all of a sudden it's like, yeah, he's going to take Robin Roberts and Charlie Steiner and Andrea Kramer and Peter Gammons. And it just started, and it's like, and it kept on going, and it kept on going, and it kept on going. And then all of a sudden you had like ESPN Chicago and ESPN LA and ESPN. Those were growth years, and they were unbridled. And there were a lot of people who made the transition from print, working for print organizations, to working for television organizations. And it was a dream for them. And I've talked to so many of them, and they loved it. And they were not only increasing their salaries, but they felt like they were at a place where there was tons of opportunity, because you got 8,760 hours a year that you can play with. And then there was ESPN2, and there was this show and everything else. Everything was expansive, manifest destiny. And then you get to a point, and I'm not saying that Jimmy Pitaro doesn't honor or respect journalists or enterprise journalism, but the truth is that the dynamic changed, the equation changed, and you couldn't go on those buying sprees, and instead you had to say goodbye to a lot of those people. There were a lot of people that came under Skipper who made huge changes in their careers and their lives to be part of that, and then when he left, they were, I would say, defenseless, and a lot of them had to leave. I mean, whether or not their contract was paid out was almost beside the point, because they didn't have another place to go, and they had already left the place that, you know, they couldn't go back to the place, or a lot of them couldn't go back. So I think that there's been a lot of disruption, but basically what we're looking at now over the last several years, and it will continue, is a fundamentally different approach to employment at ESPN. You know, I think Skipper was probably, ESPN was about 7,000 maybe at some point when Skipper was president. And now, because they shifted sales and technology and the layoffs and everything else, you know, I mean, it's under five. That's for sure. I think I'm right on those numbers. So it's a different place. And a lot of those people
close
are gone.
Close to four.
Yeah.
Close to four, but they have, they have some seasonal or transitional or contractual workers that floats that.
Right,
that,
but the,
that number,
but the point
the number
is that the engine. I mean,
we've gone
from a Porsche to an Impala.
Right. So let me ask you. Here's what I want to ask you, and I won't keep you for too much longer, because I want to sort of intentionally make this short, because I'm useless in terms of my current job now. It's just hard to focus, to be very blunt with the audience. So one of the things that was always true about ESPN, and I know you saw this in your book, and let me just preface by saying we are all guilty of this. When I was at Sports Illustrated, we used to talk about Sports Illustrated like as if it was the coolest job in the world, and we were the shit, and it was a great place to be there. And, you know, in some ways, The Athletic has that too. You know, you say you work for The Athletic and you sort of feel a certain way. It's just a little bit different because The Athletic has all these writers spread out around the country. We're all virtual, where at Sports Illustrated, you know, you'd be walking into a office across the street from Radio City. You felt like you were in the center of the world. All right. So I'm just sort of saying that as I ask Jim this question, I recognize I'm self-aware on all this shit. Okay. I'm sure it's the same if you work for Goldman Sachs, or I'm sure it's the same if you work for the Yankees. For a long time, Jim, having covered ESPN, there was like very much a swagger to people who worked there, like they were the cock of the walk. I saw it a lot, quite frankly, in their PR department, not just on-air talent. So I know Chris LaPlaca will be listening to this, or he'll have his reporter, you know, he's a big fan of yours, Jim, so he will have somebody listen to this and report back to him. And he, you know, I think if he was we put him on Truth Serum as the head of PR there would agree that there was a swagger to that place. You know, when you do a when you do an upfront in the middle of Midtown Manhattan, and that thing costs, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and, you know, Alex Rodriguez is on stage or Peyton Manning's on stage, you know, I get it. You feel like you're the center of the universe. So for a long time, there was that swagger there, and people who work there felt and imbued that swagger. Sometimes, you know, that was annoying, but hey, man, you know, you worked at ESPN. I get it. Here's what I want to ask you. Boy, that was a long-ass filibuster. Not a great job by me. So here's what I want to ask you, though. And that is, as we're sitting here taping this on January 7th, the week, by the way, the last week of Dan Le Batard's show and that group who are gone, Trey Wingo, not too long ago, is another very on-air person who was on this podcast, has left. Amina Hussein, some of you are not going to know that name, massive behind-the-scenes producer, creative force of NBA Countdown, left ESPN to go to Peloton. Had a lot of people laid off, a lot of incredibly talented people laid off in the last couple of years. Does that swagger still exist, Jim? I mean, it's obviously still a destination job. You're still going to be paid very, very well. But do you know what I'm getting at? Like, it, or is it just another place now? A cool place, but just another place.
Look, first of all, one little tiny historical mention about the swagger. I think that, remember, ESPN started from the most humble places as possible. And when ABC, you know, Wild World Sports and ABC Sports was the king of the hill, when ESPN would ask to even borrow a cable, they were kind of dismissed. And they were out in the middle of central Connecticut for many, many years, and they were, it wasn't even like, I mean, they were noticed. They were, people really, really shit on them. And there was a lot of, there were a lot of lack of respect within the business for those people. So I don't blame any of those ESPN people who grew up in that era and finally were able to be proud and strong about their job and their company. You know, you got to have some historical context on that. Look, I personally think that regardless of the brand, I mean, some brands are stronger than others, and you go in and out, and yes, Sports Illustrated is a great brand, then all of a sudden it's not, or it's in financial trouble and people get laid off there or whatever. But I think at the end of the day, those people who get to work, who wake up in the morning and who are usually great sports fans, and they're getting a paycheck for
being, it's a lottery ticket job. As is mine.
It's a great gig. And you know, is ESPN as is the moat as big around ESPN as it was 5 years ago? No. And but I think that a lot of the people, you talk to people up there all the time, I think that they're happy to be there. They're proud of their work. I think that they're probably not as cocky as before. I had a senior executive the other day tell me that, look, it's not like it used to be, and it feels smaller, and it feels, you just don't feel the power that we used to have, that, you know, and he was very honest about that. But that's because the industry has changed. It's not because all of a sudden there's a different and new sports entity that has taken the numbers away from ESPN, and now ESPN is kind of marginalized. I mean, people who work at CBS Sports and NBC Sports, Turner, whatever, I mean, you know, if you're working on the NBA show, you got to feel really good about yourself, and there's great work to be done. So I don't know. I think that there's a lot of people at ESPN who now don't take their jobs for granted. That's for sure. Because for years.
That's a pretty smart, that's a smarter way to look at it. I'm not saying, I wanted to pose the question to you. I hope I made it very clear that it's still an incredible job. And like you said, the fact that you get to wake up and work in sports in itself is a privilege and incredible. And then if you happen to be one of the chosen few that's on air, or you have one of these jobs where you're traveling to watch games, it's incredible. But yeah, you know what? I think you just hit on it. I think the difference is, and this has always been the case for anybody who works for a newspaper or something like that, is you don't take the job for granted anymore at ESPN, where I think once upon a time, you must have thought if you got there, I mean, maybe it's not a quote-unquote lifetime job, but man, it must have felt like it was pretty close to it.
Absolutely. Well, you were passing everybody in the halls who had been there for 25 years. These people, everybody, they grew up together. They moved to Central Connecticut. It's not like Manhattan where there's 10 million people there. They're all seeing each other drop off their kids at school. A lot of them lived within a 10-mile, 15-mile radius of the ESPN campus. And so, and many stayed. And so I think that's something that now they look at each other and think we're survivors. And we're lucky to be, we're still here and we're lucky to still be here. And I think that's something that, you know, gratitude isn't a big enough engine in society sometimes. And I think that the fact that they're thinking that, I think is a good thing, although it makes you sad about the others who have left.
Yeah, I will say this. It was always this must have been a Disney thing or a holdover from ABC or something. But like, it's always interesting to me that there would be people, you know, executives of ESPN who always sort of had the New York office as a bit of either a hideaway or to sort of work there for a week. And now obviously we've seen some talent, or we saw some talent during the Skipper era, negotiate to live in Manhattan or to live in New York, while working for ESPN. So that was always kind of I always thought if you worked at ESPN and you had access to sort of either working in New York, either full-time or part-time, you kind of had it all. Cause you got to work at ESPN, you had the brand on your resume, but you get to live in New York, as opposed to having to make the commitment to go to the Connecticut suburbs. No disrespect to the Connecticut suburbs. It's just a different world.
Not to get too deep in the ESPN culture, but that sometimes worked against people too, because there's a strong army of ESPNers who felt like those people who were working in New York and who were running off to New York, they really weren't die in the wool ESPNers. And you kind of get to a mentality there where, I'm sure, I don't think Norby spent a lot of time in New York, for instance, where
no.
It's like
Connor Schell did, though, right?
Oh, well, Connor, of course. Mr. New York.
Right, yeah. You're right. Yeah, I have no doubt Norby is a creature of Bristol, Connecticut, and Connecticut proper. And I would say that the product that exists today is a direct reflection of what Norby Williamson wants on the air. Well, sort of that'll be a podcast for another time. Is there anything else? Is there anything else you want to hit on before I let you go?
No, but I think that we're going to be getting some NFL. Official news. I mean, there's rumors all over the place, as always. But I think things with the NFL will be sooner rather than later. And we've been talking about it for over 2 years, and it's going to be with us for a long time. And, it'll be interesting to see how it works out.
Yeah, and as a practical matter, by the way, as on a practical matter, what Jimmy Pitaro was asked or charged to do, he has done. They have a much better relationship with the league. They're in a great position in terms of this upcoming negotiation, and they're going to be an ESPN. They're going to be an NFL rights holder. It's just really a question of what the rights are. So, in that sense, Jim, Pitaro has succeeded.
You know, well, that, as, and by as, the way,
I
think, that's
my guess is you'd agree with me.
Well, that's a huge, huge distance from. I think if Skipper had still been there,
I mean,
Iger would have overruled him, but Skipper didn't want it.
I agree.
Skipper would have walked. He just didn't think it was
well,
worth.
Let's put it this way. He might have or would have walked. Like, and I don't know if you could say that about almost any other media executive who sort of exists today with the NFL. But yeah, you know this world better than me. Whatever John Skipper wanted, I could not see Disney not overruling that. I mean, John Skipper could not unilaterally say ESPN's out of the NFL business. That I just, Disney's not going to. I couldn't see Disney as a corporation letting that happen.
No, but it would have been a very challenging negotiation.
Yes.
For Disney and for ESPN and for, look, I mean, it's not like Skipper's Laurence Olivier. He would have had to pull some acting chops out to be sitting there across the table from them.
All right. Jim Miller, you got anything to promote other than what I said at the top? Is there anything you want to promote?
Just working away on my next book and trying to finish it.
Do you want to hear me end this show, or do you want me to hang up on you, say goodbye, and then I'll do my traditional ending? I'll leave it up to you.
As I said in Princess Bride, as you wish. The one thing I will say, though, is I got to, when I started doing this book on HBO, I couldn't wait to talk about the birth of HBO Sports, and little did I know at the time, well, I kind of had a feeling, but now I get to chronicle the death of HBO Sports. So that's...
Although they still have, you know, they're still doing some stuff that, you know, they got a doc coming out with Tiger Woods and they're still doing other stuff. But yes, it's not, I mean, compared to the heyday
of sports.
Yeah, compared to the heyday of, you know, boxing and all
that
stuff.
They didn't even replace Peter Nelson. I mean, it's, you know, put a fork in it.
All right, well, good luck in that pursuit. That's going to be an interesting book, your book on HBO. All right, Jim Miller is he's the host of the Origins podcast. He's a New York Times bestselling author on many books, and he's a frequent guest of this podcast, and we always appreciate his time. Jim Miller, thank you very much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Thanks so much.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to James Andrew Miller, as always, for his time coming on. Thanks to, obviously, everybody at Cadence 13, from Patrick and Sean to Chris Corcoran and Spencer Brown and John McDermott. Not an easy one to do today, just obviously given everything that's going on in the States. It's tough to watch, and, you know, I'm always an American no matter where I live, and I'm thinking about the people in the United States right now, and all you guys listening, stay safe out there. Previous episodes, if you like this kind of conversation, Renee Paquette and Shalice Manzi-Young were my last podcast. Renee, of course, for 8 years worked in the WWE as Renee Young, and she's always awesome to talk to. And we caught up on what she's doing. Prior to that, Jimmy Traina hosted the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and Jane McManus, where Jimmy and I discussed the state of NFL broadcasting and some other issues, and Jane and I talked about college football being played this year. Trey Wingo, Ryan Rucco, Muffet McGraw. Head down the list of former podcast subjects. Hopefully you will find something that works for you. I want to thank everybody, as always, at Cadence 13 for their support and help. And everybody out there, stay safe and be well.